I want to thank you, Sean, for inviting me this morning to talk about the question of why church. Sean and I were in seminary at the same time, and so we had a lot of discussion about this question, and we read about it, and we took classes, and we talked to one another, and we developed all these theological insights of great wisdom, which you will have to take my word about or ask Sean. Because when I went to think about all the points that I'm sure Sean thought I would bring up, I could only remember this story as the answer to why church for me. It's a story of when I was a new member in my congregation back home in Canada about a woman named Pat. So I'm hoping you'll bear with me this morning through this sermon that is not really recognizably a sermon, because I think everyone gives a slightly different answer to the question of why church, and this story is my answer. "Okay," I said, pen poised over paper, "what do you say to people when they're dying?" Gary blinked. "What do they need?" I pressed him. "How do you do a good job?" "Is this about Pat?" Gary asked. I nodded. "What will she be like?" I asked with a little gulp. "Well, she'll be the same as she was last week," Gary answered. "She's been dying for 17 years. "But she's in the hospital now," I countered. Gary shrugged. At 22, I had never met a dying person before, and if I had to visit a dying person, I so desperately wanted it to be anyone but Pat. Pat was my warrior woman, grandma, badass, love-filled inspiration. She was going to be my mentor. It was Pat who greeted me that first day when I came to my new church, who shook my very sweaty hand and showed my family to a row of seats, seats where the golden light filtered through the stained glass and fell across the floor in front of us. And I scanned the brochure she'd given me, the way you run your fingers along the sleeves of a beautiful dress in the store, searching for the price tag. Because it's always there with religion. Things you have to believe, people you have to exclude. "We welcome you as you are," the speaker said from the pulpit, "with your doubts as well as your convictions, with your hopes and your fears. Whatever your faith, whatever your heritage, whomever you love, today you are a part of our religious community." I took Gary's hand and squeezed it after they said, "whomever you love." I looked rapturous. He looked ill. "I can be a minister after all. I could be a minister here," I whispered. "Can we talk about this later?" he whispered back. Gary is well behaved in church like that. "How about now?" I asked as the music of the final hymn faded away. "Can we talk about it now?" Gary thought that, "hello, I'd like to be a minister in this tradition, please," would not be the best introduction. So we waited until the walk back to the car, and I let my excitement burst out of me the way dandelions bubble over otherwise tidy lawns. Gary stared at the pavement in front of us, probably thinking about how I'd gotten him excommunicated from the last church. I gestured to the pamphlet I'd brought, explaining, "This church is different. This church will have room for our little strange family." When it comes to religion, I'm like one of those people who always has a new date for Friday night, except my dates are for Sunday morning. Or I was that way. I was constantly finding the one. I'm a junkie for new songs, new kinds of worship, new ways to connect with the great something. I am constantly having epiphanies at inopportune times. Gary is constantly awkwardly supportive, but in a "could you wait a few hours until breakfast and tell me then" kind of way. Gary prefers his epiphanies after coffee. His approach to religion was always different from mine. He always pictured himself as having one religion for life, being the kind of congregant that stood there holding his first child to be dedicated in front of the same pulpit he himself leaned on when learning to walk, the same pulpit that one day his loved ones would speak from at his funeral, telling the story of a life well-lived, intertwined with the faith that held him and his family. This is why it hurt him so much when we were kicked out of our last church. Okay, when I got us kicked out of our last church, which I was now going to fix because I'd found this new church filled with earnest, simple people who were able to casually shrug off centuries of should that I thought were sewn into the very skin of religion, as though they were kindergartners on a spring day, absent-mindedly trailing scarves and mittens and jackets across the playground. "Love makes a family," read the sign on the Sunday school door. That's all I remember from the first service. Hope, Gary's tense shoulders, the sunlight, the plants, and Pat. Also, the sign above the front door that said nuclear weapons free zone in very flowery 60s lettering. I thought all churches were nuclear weapon free zones. Will she want to talk about death? I asked, as Gary signaled to pull into the hospital parking to drop me off. Gary shrugged. Maybe. Not all dying people are the same. I stared at him flatly. This was not helpful. If she does want to talk about death, though, it's a gift to be there to listen, Gary said. Often friends and families are too uncomfortable for this conversation. I swallowed hard and silently committed myself to being totally comfortable with this conversation. Look, Gary said, dying people are... Well, Pat will know what she needs. Between the two of you, you've got this. Just follow her lead. Her lead was she asked me to bring the minutes of the Care and Connection Committee meeting, I retorted. This was clearly proof that she couldn't possibly know what she actually needed. I hope you brought them then, Gary said. I nodded. I had. A few minutes later, I stood outside Pat's door, sweaty and late. I had overprepared for the momentous conversation that might occur in the hospital room, and I had underprepared for the part that comes right before that, the part where you have to find the hospital room. I didn't realize that directions and getting lost would still be a thing in the momentousness of the impending mortality. But even late as I was, I stood frozen outside the door, stuck on the threshold of my very first ever visit to a dying person, trying to live up to my new role as the kind of church lady who effortlessly mops a sweaty brow and soothes a troubled soul. I was the new chair of the church's Care and Connection Committee. I was to be Pat's successor. Pat had taken care of people in the congregation for decades, and I was going to repay her all that kindness by doing the best hospital visit to a dying person ever. I stood there, running over potential opening sentences in my mind, maybe casual and funny, like a story about how hard it was to find the room, or spiritual and calm, or maybe a traditional opening like, how are you, but with like subtle, deep emphasis, like, how are you? Do you want some lunch? Pat called at me, peeking around the curtain, waving me in. I stumbled into her room, and I perched on the visitor's chair, and I looked at the meal tray she was pointing to. A lone aluminum can sat on the tray, and she sat smirking at it. What's that? I asked. Ensure, she said, and she wrinkled her nose. They want me to fatten up. All my life I've tried to lose weight, and they finally dropped a few pounds, and they don't like it, so they're feeding me this. What kind of idiot tries to fatten someone up with liquid meal replacement? Have they never heard of cheesecake? I could go out, I could get you, I began to offer, but Pat just laughed. I'm not hungry, she said. The cancer keeps you from feeling hungry. I held my eyes carefully still so they wouldn't widen when she said the word cancer, and I sat back in my chair and carefully relaxed my shoulders. Do you want to talk about death? I offered with casual sincerity. Not really, she shrugged. I stared at her blankly and tried to come up with a backup topic. The only two things I could think to say were, what are all those tubes and needles for? And I like cheesecake too. Neither of those seemed like deathbed talk. The way I see it, Pat said, death will happen sooner or later whether I think about it or not, and I don't believe in God or heaven or any of that stuff, so I don't have any atoning to do, so it's a time saver. She cackled after she said that. She out and out cackled. And then she looked at me, sizing me up. Her jaw jutted out like she was prepared to defend herself if I'd brought too much Jesus with me to visit. If I had him stashed in my backpack like an unwelcome can of Ensure. I hadn't brought any Jesus with me. I was almost for sure certain I didn't believe in any of that stuff either. But cackling about it seemed like a risky thing to do on your deathbed. Do you have a copy of the minutes of the Care and Connection meeting I missed? Pat asked in the pause created by my contemplation of human mortality. I nodded and pulled out the papers from my binder. How did you feel about the meeting? Pat asked, scanning the minutes. It went a little off topic, I mumbled, looking down a little. I've never chaired anything before. Pat grinned. Wouldn't matter if you chaired a dozen things. We go off topic in this group. At the time, I thought she meant the Care and Connection Committee, but it turned out later that she meant the entire religion. Possibly humans. The trick is to use structure, she explained. Let's make the agenda for the next meeting together, and I'll show you what I mean. And we were off, point by point, going through each paragraph, me drinking it all up and completely forgetting to be supportive of Pat's journey into her impending death. After she was done talking to me about church business, Pat wanted to know about me. about Gary and his work, and if he was the kind of surgical oncologist that had enough pull to get hospital policy change so they would serve cheesecake instead of Ensure. She wanted to know about the boys, how old they were, what they liked in school, how they were liking church so far, and about the wedding dress shopping and the flowers. How are the plans for the ceremony itself going? She asked eagerly. I looked down. Who's officiating? She asked conversationally. I shrank down further. She seemed to grow a little taller, and the machine that ticked off her remaining heartbeats seemed to speed up slightly. Gary and I were going to officiate it ourselves, I mumbled. Do you want to officiate your own ceremony? She asked, tilting her head to one side. No judgment, just checking. I didn't. The whole point of the ceremony was to create a sense of permanency and legitimacy, to explain to the people we loved that we were a family, to take this awkward creature that had been cobbled together out of tragedy and rejected in so many places and make it real. A divorce and remarriage would have been bad enough. In this day and age, though, people could have learned to look past it, especially given the circumstances. It would be better if Maureen had died, of course, but we might have gotten away with acting as though she had. We might have gotten away with leaving her behind, quarantined into an institutional room somewhere, to struggle with the bubbling darkness that burned her mind into mottled, crispy patches. We might have hidden her, like the blackened dish you stash in the cupboard minutes before a dinner party. We might have weathered it if we'd been more subtle, more graceful. The way you pretend that the subtle smell of burning isn't there at the party, the way you make small talk. How you open all the windows to try and clear the smoke and bring in fresh air. I had come in as fresh air. Maureen had hired me, first as a babysitter, then as a nanny. And as she grew more frantic, grasping at her mind as it blazed through visions and demons and crumpled into the blank fragility of spent ash, she asked me how I would feel about being the boys' stepmother. They loved me, and I loved them. She loved me, I loved her. Gary was starting to love me, I was starting to love him. We bonded over these tiny moments of grace that we found in the middle of the struggle to hold everyone together. Me cracking jokes to distract everyone from Maureen's shaking hands and Gary's forced laughter eventually relaxing into awkward and stolen moments of joy. And that was a lot of love. Over time, I came to believe there didn't have to be a forced choice between Maureen and I. There was room for both of us in the family. We could be as much a family as her illness and eventual institutionalization would allow. And so we held on to the family we had, using whatever ways to connect we could find, phone calls punctuated by long silences where Maureen fought to push anxiety down in her mind, the way you fight with your body to suppress a gag. Weekend visits in painted hospital rooms, the boys showing off whichever art projects I would let through, scowling at me when I censored the ones I thought would remind her of demons. I stand by this decision. Children's paper mache masks remind everyone of demons. We had Christmases around the tree, opening presents and eating sweets in small blocks of time, leaving breaks in between for Maureen to lie down. And in between those visits, there was me, buying school clothes, signing forms, struggling for all I was worth to be the next best thing to a real mother and a real wife. There was no divorce. The same demons that held her in the hospital also encircled her with stories about where divorced women go when they die. And I wanted no part of making that any more real to her than it already was. I couldn't just stay the nanny either. After years of not being sure if I would disappear from underneath them, the boys needed me to stand up in a white dress and say it once and for all, you have two mothers now, and we're a real family, all of us. There would simply have to be two wives. It was the only reasonable option. And so we were excommunicated in the subtle, eye-averting way that Mennonites do so perfectly. Now, if it weren't for the kids, we wouldn't have needed a ceremony at all. Maureen didn't need it. She wasn't anywhere close to well enough to attend. I didn't need it, neither did Gary. But the boys needed the family that we'd patched together out of all those years of loss to be marked as real, chosen, blessed. Well, no minister was going to touch that kind of ceremony, I thought. So we would do it ourselves, up on our own, humiliatingly aware that there was nobody willing to stand beside us. Hand me the phone, Pat answered as I finished telling her this story. I will call Tony. Who's Tony? I asked. I wasn't even sure what to ask or how to ask it. He does weddings, Pat said happily. You can meet with him. You can see if you're interested in what he has to offer. Will he offer? I asked in a small voice. Love makes a family, Pat said firmly. That's kind of our thing. But are we allowed to, I began again with kind of growing hope. Who could stop us, said Pat. This is what we do, she said, her voice filled with joy and pride as she dialed Tony's number from memory. This here is the whole point of it all. As she said this, she waved a hand in my direction in a sweeping gesture, rattling all the needles and tubes. I thought she was gesturing to us and our little ceremony. It would be much later that I would learn how much more she was talking about. All the families, the weird ones and the normal ones and all the ones in between. The ones with or without kids, with or without partners, the ones made out of knitting clubs, networks of friendships forged in gay bars. This was a hand sweep that gestured not just to families, but to all the ways that we connect. These connections, every last one of them, are the point of it all the things that love makes, as central to my new religion as meetings that go off topic. I should have known this stuff already, maybe. I was already a member when this visit happened. My signature is in the little book, so I can piece together that we must have done the thing where the newcomers stand up in the service and we all say a few words. I don't remember a single bit of that part, though. I just remember this moment with Pat. Her dying in bed with tubes in and out of her, surrounded by charts and doctors, looking for all the world like a cross between a spaceman and a church lady and a mob boss. And that sweep of her hand. And I want to say it was an encircling, a moment of blessing, but it was much more practical, much more swatty than that. Like she was directing divine traffic. Unimportant things like silly rules about how many wives were allowed in one marriage would have to wait. It was our family's turn to go ahead. And it was like she was waving off her own death too, as though death were this annoying insect that kept circling her, a fly that couldn't land so long as she kept moving. It was like she was saying to it, hold on just a minute, I got one more thing to do. Death would need to wait because there was this stuttering, anxious young mother that needed her. As dying people go, Pat never seemed appropriately dying-y to me. She failed to prepare, and she also kept failing to die. She just kept living. She kept getting distracted by the scenery and missing her exit. And even when she left, she stayed. I tell my first baby that his middle name, Patrick, comes from a woman who is gone but not gone. I don't tell him that she went to heaven. I tell him she became part of the earth and the flowers grew over her and they were higher and bigger and more beautiful than they ever could have been without her tickling their roots and feeding them. He hums Circle of Life from The Lion King as he's playing Lego. And I struggle to find a way to explain that it isn't just our bodies that do this, it's our stories too. That our family exists now with those first boys all grown up and the two new ones in their place asking if Auntie Maureen will be well enough to come visit this weekend, our family exists under that umbrella of Pat's blessing. That our church, too, grows out of her the way forests grow out of nurse logs. That we come together in ways that reach back deep into the centuries of history and will reach forward, too. We change how we gather. But this precious act of coming together across generations to mark what is sacred, be it a union or a funeral or the start of a new week, this act holds a unique power. We have inherited something unspeakably precious. The church my children will become stewards of will be transformed in so many ways from the one Pat once helped build, but it will carry her story in its cells. And one of the stories is that wedding. Pat there in the front row passing out tissues to people who forgot to bring any, singing along to We Laugh, We Cry, which would be sung weeks later at her funeral, and again a year later at the dedication of a child who is about to be conceived. I remember Pat gazing up at us, her whole face lit up with a grin that almost sizzled with the joy of it, holding her breath, watching the trailing sleeve of my dress as Gary and I leaned over to light 5 candles at the start of the service, one for each of the 2 boys and one for each of we 3 parents. Pat, aware of the symbolism and the joy and the sacredness, as well as the location of both of the fire extinguishers. When we finished, without lighting anyone on fire, Pat grinned at Tony, and Tony grinned at Pat, and they both grinned at Gary and I. And I remember feeling like my whole congregation, my whole faith was standing beside us in that moment. The tiny flames on those candles, a hearth fire that I didn't even know I was searching for until my new church opened its arms for me and welcomed my family home. "Whomever you love," they said on that first day, they meant it.